Good morning and welcome. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. And welcome to our folks on Zoom. I'm Robin Proud. I'm one of your rotating speakers, and I'm happy to be here on 2 feet. Last time I was here with a boot on after I had fractured my ankle, I got to ride in your elevator, which was thrilling, but I'm happy to not need that today. Our opening words from Ursula Le Guin. The story from Rumpelstiltskin to War and Peace is one of the basic tools invented by the human mind for the purpose of gaining understanding. There have been great societies that did not use the wheel, but there have been no societies that did not tell stories. Much like the Brothers Grimm stories in Europe, the 1001 Nights is a collection of tales told in Asia. They were passed on through generations. They were edited, altered, and restructured as cultures changed. But after centuries, storytellers started to write them down, eventually forming what we know as the 1001 Nights or Arabian Nights. In an early example of a framing device, it's Scheherazade's story and narrative that binds together the rest of the stories. So who was she? Well, the story goes that once upon a time, a sultan of a big and powerful empire left his castle to embark on a hunting trip. Returning unexpectedly early, he caught his beloved wife in bed with servants. Enraged, he beheaded them all on the spot. He went to the estate of his brother, who was away at the time. He decided to stay in one of the outhouse guest rooms. Here lay his next staggering revelation. Past midnight, he started to hear music from the gardens and open windows. Exploring, he was shocked beyond belief to find his brother's wife among a small crowd of nude figures, dancing in the moonlight and indulging in desires. Stunned by the turn of events, he returned to court, blinded with a desire for revenge. Engrossed in feelings of betrayal and rage, he vowed to take revenge on all womankind by beginning a monstrous tradition. He would take a new virgin wife every night, only to behead her the following morning, so as not to allow her the opportunity to cheat. In the Sultan's madness, the kingdom became a hostile place for all young women. Families fled elsewhere with their daughters, as the Sultan continued with his rage-filled murder. Sick with worry, the vizier, who was an advisor to the Sultan, the vizier urged his daughters to leave. He had to stay in the capital and fulfill his duties. But his two daughters, Scheherazade and Dunyazade, could flee. Here the story gets interesting as Scheherazade refuses to leave and instead insists on becoming the Sultan's next bride. After many attempts to try and make her see sense, and much to the vizier's dismay, Scheherazade and the Sultan were married. On Scheherazade's wedding night, as a last wish, she begged for her sister's company. Dunyazade joined them and requested one last tale from her sister. With the Sultan's approval, Scheherazade started her very first story. So captivating and mesmerizing were her charm and her storytelling capabilities, it was almost dawn before anyone realized. Clever Scheherazade ended the night's storytelling on a captivating turn, leaving her audience on edge, wanting more. The Sultan was so engrossed in the story that, to everybody's surprise, he allowed her to live one extra night to finish it. Of course, the following night, she finished the first story and began another one. She continued this night after night, always ending on a tantalizing twist. Scheherazade continued telling her tales for 1001 nights, and in that time, the Sultan started to fall for her beauty, charm, and intelligence. He eventually saw the error of his ways and the injustices he'd wrought. Professing this true love for Scheherazade, they finally began a life together. The bloodlust stopped and peace was restored. Now, I found this just by looking for a more complete story of Scheherazade. I found it on a website called artuk.org. And if you turn to the front picture here in your playbill or program, this was all written to accompany this painting, which is Scheherazade by Sophie Jean-Gebre Anderson, a British artist born in France. Heavily influenced by neoclassicism and pre-Raphaelitism, Anderson's work reflected both styles. She often painted children. Because most of her themes involved home life, women, and children, her work sometimes gets written off as kitsch or just for women. But this author says that's preposterous. Most of history has been told, painted, and recorded by, and one could argue, for men. During Anderson's time, exploring themes that would interest and include female audiences was a pioneering concept. In the painting, we find Scheherazade in a typical Victorian portrait posture. Her long dark hair is separated into braids, and the jewelry and fabric she is adorned in celebrate traditional Arabic culture and garments. It's interesting how Anderson did not paint her with too much glitter and glamour. And some of the paintings of Scheherazade by men are very sexualized. She is a temptress. Here she comes off as a character from a relatively well-to-do family, but not quite a queen. The peacock feather on her head is interesting. With a metaphorical all-seeing eye, peacocks hold the status of a sacred emblem. The feather represents a pure soul, the one that cannot be tarnished. In the soft light, Scheherazade's facial features are brought out with a kind resonance. There is patience in her eyes, perhaps hinting at her persistence through the 1001 nights of storytelling to please the Sultan. And that was written by Bristi Chowdhury for artuk.org. And it really fit with my theme of women using different weapons, as we saw in The Paper Bag Princess, using words and perhaps psychology to achieve their aims. Now, a few years back, I spoke to you about the work of Joseph Campbell on worldwide mythology. A lot of you know his groundbreaking work, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, that was published over 50 years ago. He shows that similar stories exist in diverse populations and eras, whether the hero is Hercules, Jesus, Buddha, Luke Skywalker, or Harry Potter. Many elements are the same. The hero usually has a humble beginning, receives a call, and goes on a journey. Along the way, he encounters helpers and hinderers. He often must complete tasks of strength or skill, culminating in a battle of some kind. He then returns home with a treasure, which might be literal, like gold, or figurative, such as wisdom. The underlying idea is that these stages of the story correspond to human needs and desires as we go through the ages of our life, such as separating from childhood or dealing with obstacles in life. Now, not long after I gave that talk, I came across a book entitled Jane Eyre's Sisters, How Women Live and Write the Heroine Story by Jody Gentian Bauer, published in 2015. Bauer's view was that the hero's journey, as described by Campbell, doesn't apply to the stories of women in most times and places. While the boy must leave home in order to become a man, the girl has to leave home in order to avoid becoming a woman in the sense of being restricted and dominated. And in that book, she gave examples from folk tales and more modern literature. Of course, neither of these books give us the truth about human life, but they're ways of looking at stories that speak to us. So I was very interested to learn recently of a brand new book called The Heroine with 1001 Faces by Maria Tatar. Tatar is an expert on fairy tales and folk tales around the world. She has a special chair at Harvard. She's the editor of the Norton Critical Edition of the Classic Fairy Tales and the Annotated Brothers Grimm, and co-editor of the Annotated African American Folk Tales. That is, she knows the world of stories. So today I'll share with you some highlights from her take on women in story around the world. Now, Tatar says she admires the work of Campbell. She is not looking to contradict him, but to expand. She does start with a story about Campbell. Joseph Campbell wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces while teaching at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. His classes on comparative mythology at the then all-women's school were in such high demand that he was soon obliged to limit enrollment to seniors. During his last year of teaching there, one of those seniors walked into his office, sat down, and said, "Well, Mr. Campbell, you've been talking about the hero, but what about the women?" The startled professor raised his eyebrows and replied, "The woman's the mother of the hero. She's the goal of the hero's achieving. She's the protectress of the hero. She's this, she's that. What more do you want?" "I want to be the hero," she announced. So this book tries to answer that question. and talks about women who wear curiosity as a badge of honor rather than a mark of shame, and how women's connection to knowledge, often linked to sin and transgression or censured as prying, is in fact often symptomatic of empathy, care, and concern. So we'll see more about that. Tatar says that Campbell found what he was looking for, that is, a male point of view. Today, some new visions of the old stories are being written. The novel Circe by Madeline Miller tells the story of that sorceress who turned Odysseus' men into pigs. Now, the title of this book, The Heroine with 1,001 Faces, comes from the 1,001 Nights, and she says that in Arabic, 1,001 is a metaphor for a vast measure, a vast number. And indeed, Scheherazade used the skills of imagination and curiosity to save her own life and that of her people. Tatar says, heroines often share a crusading spirit, and the goals of their missions often pale by comparison with the shining glory bestowed on heroes. Still, the rebel and her cause are often right there, trying to rescue, restore, or fix things with words as their only weapons. Heroes and heroines have deployed different strategies for earning merit. The one, rousingly percussive in most cases, the other stereotypically veiled and still, yet also quietly creative and deeply inspiring. Today, we may be expanding our understanding with new non-binary gender fluid identities. That fact makes it all the more important to understand the culturally scripted performances and inflexible binary codes enacted in the myths, legends, and fairy tales from time past. Now, Campbell had acknowledged that the central figures of myth, who were largely male, did have equivalents in female characters of fairy tales. But he, with most other scholars, dismissed these stories as literally old wives' tales. When we hear the word hero, we think of action, fighting, and war. We rarely think of saints, artists, or helpers, although men have regularly taken on those roles. Many of the most famous stories are about conflict. For example, just in Europe, there's the Iliad, the Song of Roland, El Cid, and Beowulf. But let's look at a woman from a classic hero story, Penelope, wife of Odysseus. While Odysseus makes his way home from Troy past monsters, witches, and the wrath of the gods and goddesses, Penelope sits at home, besieged by suitors who assume her husband is dead. She has the desired female virtues of fidelity and domesticity, as compared to the beautiful Helen, who is destructive, adulterous, and caused all the trouble in the first place. Yet Penelope resists in her own way. She tells her suitors she cannot wed until she finishes weaving a shroud for her dead husband. But every night in secret, she rips out the weaving she has done during the day. Thus, she saves herself and her son from the domination of a new husband. The problem we have with Penelope and other heroines is that we know them from the stories written and told by men. In 2005, the writer Margaret Atwood wrote an extended poem called The Penelope Ad, telling the story of Odysseus' wife and also of the maids who in the original story are all killed for their betrayal. Tatar links the newness of a woman's voice to a phrase that happened to be coined 1 year after Margaret Atwood's telling, and that phrase was Me Too. You may not know that the phrase was started by a Black woman, Tarana Burke. It was so long ago that it happened on MySpace, if anyone remembers that platform. In 2017, it was picked up again during an era of more publicity for women's stories. The request at that time was, if all the women who have been sexually harassed or assaulted wrote Me Too as a status, we might give people a sense of the magnitude of the problem. Overnight, more than 30,000 women signed on, and of course, more after that. Indeed, our author, Maria Tatar, has her own story from her student days. She said she was cornered by a male faculty member who declared his passion for redheaded Eastern European women. She was able to escape from his office, but never spoke up to anyone because he was on her dissertation committee. In fact, that professor tried to deny her the PhD. Fortunately, he was overruled by the rest of the panel. It was only decades later that Tatar realized how she had silenced herself. She saw how similar her story was to actresses who put up with Harvey Weinstein because they wanted to save their careers, or working class women in factories or restaurants who went along with uncomfortable comments and groping because they needed the job. And yes, I would say there are current attacks on abortion have very little to do with the children involved and a lot to do with controlling women. Now, when you start looking at this from the Me Too angle, the Greek myths read like a rap sheet. I'm rather amazed that when I was around 9 years old, I was reading stories of Zeus foisting himself on women in the guise of a bird, an animal, or a shower of gold. Paintings of these mythological stories, all the way into the 19th century, were not that different from Playboy centerfolds. They were done by men. They depicted scantily clad women who are shown enjoying the honor of these assaults. Then there's the story of Persephone, kidnapped by Hades and held against her will underground, tricked by her captor into consuming pomegranate seeds, which means she could only ascend to the earth for half the year. Well, silencing women has a long history in stories. To return to Penelope, her son Telemachus banishes her from the great hall, saying, "Take up your own work, the loom and the distaff. Speech will be the business of men, all men and me most of all." This reminds me of another Greek, St. Paul, who supposedly said that women should be silent in church and submissive to men. There are numerous stories of women who have their tongues cut out or who are turned into plants or animals so they cannot speak their truth. Sometimes nature assists the silent woman when birds or winds carry her story to the public. These girls often have a strong bond with the natural world. Think of all those Disney princesses singing with mice, birds, and other adorable creatures. In modern day, we are learning the stories of women silenced by tabloids who bought their stories and shut them down, by judges and juries dismissing their complaints, by powerful men such as Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, using their media clout to disparage the victims. And apparently, it's sadly because he was a hero for my neighborhood in Philadelphia, but apparently Cosby literally preferred his victims silent and comatose, just like Snow White and Sleeping Beauty. Now, as I mentioned, the fairy tales were long dismissed by male collectors of folklore as trivial entertainments for women and children. They also neglected to write down those stories that didn't fit their idea of appropriateness. Little Red Riding Hood sometimes ends with the girl being eaten as a punishment for not following the rules, or she's rescued by a man, the woodcutter. But there is a version where the girl actually laughs at the wolf's threats, and the two end up living together happily and sharing grandma's bed. This is really interesting when you realize that the threat of a wolf and many other beasts in tales is a sexual threat. Maria Tatar points out how many stories criticize curiosity or the thirst for knowledge in women. There's Pandora, who opens the box that lets out all the world's ills. There's Eve, who desires knowledge for herself and her mate. There's Bluebeard's wife, who is instructed not to open a door, but who does so and finds evidence of his crimes. In these stories, women wanting to know things always leads to a bad end. And Tatar reproduces several artworks that show both Eve and Pandora as temptress-type beings. Well, eventually, 19th century literature gave us some heroines who are not afraid to speak up, including Jane Eyre and Josephine March from Little Women. Later, there was Anne of Green Gables. While the boy heroes in Huckleberry Finn, Treasure Island, and Captain's Courageous go on travels and risk death, girls like Pollyanna, Heidi, Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm mostly stay home. But they travel in imagination. Jo from Little Women writes what she calls blood and thunder stories. Anne Shirley from Anne of Green Gables has a great imagination. Francie Nolan of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn wants to be a writer. Then we have a real-life girl who wrote in her diary, "If I don't have the talent to write books or newspaper articles, I can always write for myself. I want to go on living even after my death." Well, that girl, whose name was Anne Frank, is known today for expressing herself. A recent book and movie, The Hate U Give, focuses on a Black teenager, Star Carter. She witnesses the police shooting of a friend and has to decide whether and how to speak up and how to deal with the inevitable repercussions. In the mid-20th century, Betty Friedan famously wrote in her book, The Feminine Mystique, that women felt pressure to get married and have babies because, quote, there is no other way for a woman to be a heroine. Around the same time, there was another model proposed by Helen Gurley Brown, Sex and the Single Girl. That book eschewed marriage and children, but it gave another stereotyped role, the beautiful seductress. Into this moment, ripe for cultural change, came some new examples of women's roles, sometimes as detectives. Now, the women aren't detectives in the mold of Sherlock Holmes or the police captains or some of those anti-heroes in the noir films. They tend to look deceptively weak. Sometimes they're small and pretty, or elderly and confused. Miss Marple just seems to be a sweet old lady chatting away or gossiping when she's actually investigating. One of my favorite literary heroes is Lord Peter Wimsey from the Dorothy Sayers Mysteries. He hires a group of elderly women because they can go anywhere and win the trust of people with their innocent appearance. They aren't driven by a desire for revenge or money, but by a wish to uphold justice and to be of use. And in fact, in one of the Lord Peter stories, his friend Detective Inspector Parker of Scotland Yard says, "People want questions asked. Whom do they send? A man with large flat feet and a notebook. The sort of man whose private life is conducted in a series of inarticulate grunts." But Lord Peter's strategy is to send, quote, "a lady with a long woolly jumper on knitting needles and jingly things around her necks. When she asks questions, nobody is surprised, nobody is alarmed." And there's also a resonance here about the weaving, spinning, knitting. And of course, knitting could remind us of Madame Defarge in Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities, who used her knitting to track the guilt of aristocrats. One of the first physically active detectives was a young one, Nancy Drew. Generations of women have now grown up inspired by Nancy's independence, courage, and intelligence. Conveniently, Nancy has no mother and an indulgent father who provides her with her car, a roadster. Well, Nancy can not only drive cars, boats, and so on, but fix them, as well as carrying heavy loads and thinking logically, even in difficult situations. She does anything a young man could do. In the descendants of Nancy Drew and her devotion to justice, you have Hillary Clinton, who has described her love of Nancy. And in fiction, someone like Hermione in Harry Potter, who's up for any challenge and who takes on social justice issues. But it's not till the mid-20th century that fighting women become a cultural norm, with Wonder Woman joining the comic book craze. And that's a whole story in itself. There is a wonderful book about the creation of Wonder Woman, that the man who did this had very radical views on things like marriage and society, and felt that women could bring different virtues. He made up a whole mythology where Wonder Woman is found in this Amazonian culture. She rescues an American pilot and comes back. She disguises herself as a secretary in his office. But in later comic books, she actually fights evil and injustice by organizing strikes, boycotting products, and leading political rallies. She ends the excesses of profiteering on the part of a milk trust that has been raising the price of its product and starving American children. She becomes a labor activist who works to double the salaries of underpaid clerks at Bullfinch's department stores. Blistering Blazes, this is her American employer, declares, "Why will that beautiful gal always invite trouble? If she'd only married me, she'd be home cooking my dinner right now." Now, among the descendants of Wonder Woman, we have Elizabeth Salander from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. She's physically strong and mentally brilliant, and Tatar says she's most often on the wrong side of the law, but the right side of justice. So this reminds me of male heroes like Robin Hood, and that is also an ancient figure, which is the trickster. And although she detests the comparison, Elizabeth Salander has much in common with her Swedish ancestor, Pippi Longstocking, who also broke rules, had physical strength, and the cleverness to outsmart authority. The Game of Thrones series gave us a whole new range of strong women, warriors, queens, and strategists. The Hunger Games gave us Katniss and launched a craze among kids for archery. So these new heroines reject the activities and the characteristics of the classical heroine, and they tend to have an androgynous appearance, along with skills such as fighting previously reserved for males. Even the Disney company has adapted to modern times. The old princesses, Cinderella, Snow White, and Sleeping Beauty, and more recently, the Little Mermaid who gives up her voice for love, have been replaced by fighters in Mulan and Brave, another archery story. And in Frozen, the prince turns out to be unworthy, just like in the Paper Bag Princess. And the true love in Frozen is between the sisters. And apparently there's a sequel, Frozen 2, where the young women fight against environmental destruction. Moana in that movie goes on a journey to save her people in the Joseph Campbell way. And one of the things she does is to unmask the supposed hero who actually caused the problems. So where are we now? There are many stories now of intelligent and strong women. The past is being re-examined. For instance, a recent study suggests that many of the handprints in the early cave paintings are of women. Women are getting more college degrees, and until the pandemic, women were weathering changes in employment better than men. Right-wing speakers bemoan the loss of, quote, masculinity in America and elsewhere. Even those on the progressive end aren't quite sure what the role and value should be for men who reject the stereotypes of the past. One would hope that gains made by one gender wouldn't cause losses by the other, but that new ways of being a hero can emerge for anyone along the wide spectrum of gender identity. And Maria Tatar concludes, "The women writers who dared to speak and shape new ways of thinking about our world also created new tools, less for dismantling what we have than for building rich new alternatives. They also displayed a shared solidarity in their passion for defining our aspirations, offering up 1,001 possible ways to be a heroine. They have made it possible to reimagine the future, and they help us understand how care, empathy, compassion, and new forms of justice driven by communal grassroots efforts rather than institutional top-down forces are leading us to turn our backs on the heroic ideals we once embraced." So I would like to hear if people have comments on that. I was just thinking that although we certainly have had women who embodied a lot of the traditional male attributes, like someone like Margaret Thatcher, that studies did show that the countries that responded best to the pandemic tended to be led by women. The countries with the most macho leaders tended to have the most issues. Do we have comments, questions, or other examples from either stories or popular culture? And again, this is not to bash men in any way, but that in some ways men were trapped in this particular mold of what a man is supposed to be. That was always the point, I think, of these stories, even with the male heroes. It wasn't that everybody hearing them was going to go out on a quest, but in their own lives, they were going to go through things that were happy, sad. Women, for almost all of history, took their lives into their hands every time they became pregnant and could die at any time. There were many other life issues that were going on. Yeah, and you do see that in Jane Eyre. For Jane Eyre, she actually does physically leave at one point, but she makes herself strong enough to make her own choices. Yeah, I just said a couple of short things about her at her retirement. That, of course, she grew up in the communist East Germany, which is why she could speak Russian fluently with Putin. And she's a scientist, which is always which might be nice if we had more scientists in government. But certainly her, apparently she was called Mutti or mother, right? Mom by a lot of her followers. And yet she doesn't strike anyone as being, overly feminized or, very, that's like a sweet old lady at anything like that. She seems certainly very tough, but she made this declaration about taking in all this immigrants and said, "We will manage," which seems like a very, It seems like the kind of thing that woman head of household often has to do. So, there are all different ways that this could look. I think there isn't just one vision. I think, I mean, what we're realizing or admitting in the last 20, 30, 40 years is that there's not always a very clear delineation with all these people are over here and all these people are over there, that there's a whole continuum of the ways that people live and experience relationships and sexuality and their experience of life. And certainly if you talk to younger people, they have a different view of it. I don't think anyone's looking to impose anything. If anything, they were trying to remove categories that people felt they had to be stuck in, but that doesn't mean that everyone has to be the same, but that's a whole other area that could be explored with biology and psychology. Well, there's certainly a backlash to the fact that these are out in public before the internet and before a lot of, when I was in high school, I read an article in Newsweek magazine about homosexuality, and that was really the first that I even knew this was a thing or an issue. And of course, people growing up dealing with this sometimes thought they were the only one in the world. There was just nothing was there. So the fact that these things are out there, my mother worked at a job, and most people that I knew, their mothers did not do that. So, that wasn't the standard. So anytime you have something that is standard, and then there's more and more evidence that it doesn't have to be that way, that does induce some fear and backlash. And I do think there are legitimate concerns today about the fact that boys are not going to college, or that men are not finding satisfying jobs. That are legitimate concerns to look at. So I think the more I read about any of these issues, whether it's sexism, racism, so much of it comes back to capitalism in the end. So if we do get things like family leave and more support for early childhood education, it'll be because they want women to go out to work, which wouldn't be a bad thing. Yeah, well, in 1950, you couldn't have had the hair that you have without getting a lot of people looking at you. Now, by 1970, it would be fine. I'm watching that Beatles documentary is wonderful. If you like the Beatles at all, it's worth subscribing to Disney Plus for a month just so you can see it. But the hair on these guys, I've forgotten what it was like in 1969. So yes, expressions of various kinds, and definitely you see that with, I would say, high school and college students, that there are various populations, but there's certainly a lot more visibility for personal expression. People find what they're looking for. There was another thing recently where, was it a Viking warrior? Some kind of warrior that was found, and then through DNA or through looking at the bones, they were able to prove this was a woman. But people who found this some decades ago, of course, assumed it was a man. And yes, in nature, you do have these things like I'm sure one of the books being banned now in Texas is this sweet little book about the two male penguins who are a couple, and they get to adopt a baby penguin. But that story was too threatening for some people. Well, I think our time is running out, but I appreciate all those comments. There are no particular answers. These are just ways of thinking about things. And I'd be happy to talk to anyone afterwards.
Thanks to all.